This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You might not know their names, but brothers Charles and David Koch have quietly given more than $100 million to right-wing causes, underwriting a huge network of foundations, think tanks, and political groups. Jane Mayer reports on the Koch brothers in the current edition of The New Yorker in an article titled Covert Operations, The Billionaire Brothers Who Are Waging a War Against Obama. She says the Koch brothers have become the primary underwriters of hardline libertarian politics in America, and their views dovetail with their corporate interests. Charles, who is 74, and David, who is 70, own virtually all of Koch Industries, a conglomerate whose annual revenues are estimated to be $100 billion. The Kochs operate oil refineries in several states and control some 4,000 miles of pipelines. Koch Industries owns Brawny Paper Towels, Dixie Cups, Georgia-Pacific Lumber, Stainmaster Carpet, and Lycra, and is ranked by Forbes as the second largest private company in the country after Cargill. Just to clarify, Koch is spelled K-O-C-H. Jane Mayer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. She writes about politics and the war on terror. Jane Mayer, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, you say that by giving money to fund political groups like Tea Party protesters, they've helped turn their private agenda into a mass movement. So before we get to who they've given money to, what do you consider to be the Koch brothers' private agenda?
Well, they are longtime, very hardline libertarians. So their private agenda is really the eradication of the federal government in almost all of its forms other than the parts of it that protect personal rights. They have been working to fight the federal government really since the 1970s, and their father was doing it before they were. So they're trying to get rid of federal regulations, particularly on energy companies like their own. They particularly have been at war with environmental regulations, and they have a history of serious and even criminal pollution problems. And they're very anti-tax in almost every form.
Now, you describe the Koch brothers as waging a war against President Obama. What are some of the things that they've funded in opposition to the Obama administration?
Well, they have funded various kinds of front groups and organizations that have come at Obama from many directions at once, which is kind of what got me interested in the story, because if you kind of pick up the rocks and take a look at what's under them, so often you find roots, financial roots that go back to the Koch brothers. And I'm talking about in particularly opposition to Obama's health care policy, opposition to Obama's environmental policies, energy policies, tax policies, the stimulus program. You name it, they are against it. And you can pretty much find money coming through their family foundations I counted just recently 34 different organizations that have been involved in policy and politics, mostly in opposition to Obama.
Now, you give an example in your New Yorker article of a July 4th summit, a Tea Party summit that was funded by Americans for Prosperity in Texas. It was called Texas Defending the American Dream. And you say an ad cast the event as a populist uprising against vested corporate power. And it said, today the voices of average Americans are being drowned out by lobbyists and special interests, but you can do something about it. And there was no mention anywhere of the special interest huge corporate power that was helping to fund this Tea Party summit. Why does Americans for Prosperity not mention anywhere that you could find that, David Koch, who is a billionaire and owns all these corporate interests, is behind it, even though they're saying it's an anti-corporate group?
Well, it is an irony. And the thing is that you would really have to ask them why they want to obscure their hand in this. And I did try to ask them, but one of their characteristics is that they are really press shy and underground, and particularly when it comes to describing their political activity. So they wouldn't answer any questions about it.
What other aspects of the Tea Party movement have the Koch brothers funded?
It's interesting. They were involved almost from the start of the Tea Party movement, and they put up websites that helped organize rallies. They helped pay for buses that got people to the rallies. They've provided various kinds of sort of political infrastructure that has made the movement possible. kind of fanned the insurrection in various ways. But the other thing that's interesting to me is that they've tried to channel the very legitimate and genuine anger that's out there in the country about economic problems and push it in towards their own agenda. It's not that they were the very creators of this anger. It's more that they've tried to take the anger and model it. And I've got a quote in the story from someone named Bruce Bartlett, who is a Republican and conservative historian and economist who actually worked for one of the Koch organizations. And he explains that for years they've been trying to turn their politics of kind of libertarianism into a mass movement. And the Tea Party is what provided the sort of the troops out on the street for them to do that.
So how does the Tea Party meet the Koch brothers' agenda?
Well, it provides bodies on the street. It provides ideological, you know, voice to an agenda that they've got. Basically, if you take the example of the Texas branch of Americans for Prosperity, because I went down to Austin to see it, what they are doing is training angry people in issues that they care about. They are trying to get people to fight regulations, fight energy reform, fight environmental reform, and they also provide education about who those angry people should target in the way of candidates and politicians, and how they should do it. They even provide scripts. They've handed out talking points for the Tea Party.
Do you think that most of the people who see themselves as members of the Tea Party don't know about the corporate money behind it, don't know, for instance, that the Koch brothers are supporting a lot of the Tea Party activities?
You know, I just don't know.
By supporting, I mean funding. Yeah.
It's hard to tell. I mean, when I was down in the Austin convention talking to Tea Party people, there were a lot of people who had conspiracy theories about money flowing into American politics. But, you know, ironically, none of the people that I interviewed seemed to be focused on the Koch brothers. They were kind of obsessed with the possible role played by George Soros in particular. So I didn't find anyone who seemed focused on the Koch's role.
You actually talked to one of Soros' spokespeople and asked them for their take on this, because, you know, Soros is seen as like the great funder of liberal causes. And you quote a spokesperson as saying that Soros's funding is transparent. He doesn't secretly, you know, covertly fund things. And also none of his contributions are in the service of his own economic interests.
And that was Michael Vachon who said that. And I can see out there on the internet blogs that this is it had become kind of a war between red America and blue America about which billionaire, you know, creates more trouble in American politics. And, you know, in some ways I sort of think of it as choose your poison. The point is not to say that, you know, not to defend George Soros. It's to question really the role of these huge fortunes in flooding money into American politics. And I actually wrote a very tough piece about George Soros for the New Yorker magazine also. So it's not that we're championing one over the other necessarily, but I can tell you one thing, which is when I did write about George Soros and hit the fortune, questioning the amount of money he was putting into politics, there was a big difference between writing about Soros and writing about the Koch brothers. George Soros spent days talking to me and let me watch his operation pretty closely. And he puts out a lot of information about where his money is going. By contrast, the Koch family refused to answer even the most fundamental question about their activities. They are, as I quote somebody saying who worked for them, they are not just under the radar, they are underground. And you cannot get this information out of them. So they prefer to be a much more closeted political force.
Thus, your article is headlined Covert Operations. Any idea why they're so covert?
Well, I think that you know, again, I'm going on the interviews that I did with people who worked with them to get some insight. And one of them told me something I thought was interesting, which was that they prize their privacy. Remember, again, this is a privately owned company, partly because they want to avoid the scrutiny of possible congressional investigations into their activities. They don't want controversy to be associated with the brands they sell. It might get in the way of their business. And so they don't want people to think when they're picking up brawny paper towels that, hey, this money is going into attacking Obama, because, you know, they don't want that kind of controversy. They'd rather hide behind groups that do their work for them. I have a quote from someone who says they use rednecks to do their dirty work for them. And that was someone who worked for them who said that.
So getting back to the seemingly grassroots groups that the Koch brothers have funded and gotten off the ground, these groups are sometimes called AstroTurf because it's fake grassroots. How did that become part of their strategy?
Well, it goes way back. And in fact, I think one of the things that really caught my interest about them was that their story is such a big piece of American political history. They've been working at this project really since before 1980, when David Koch became vice president for the Libertarian presidential ticket. It was a miserable failure in 1980. They got 1% of the vote. And at that point, David Koch and his brother Charles Koch decided that if they wanted to have an impact on American politics, they were going to have to do something other than run for office. It was clear that their ideas did not do well in the marketplace of the ballot box. And so at that point, they kind of put their heads together with some other fellow travelers and decided that they were going to fund a complete infrastructure of organizations that were aimed at manufacturing political public opinion that mirrored their own. And so they set about doing this. And they've been doing it ever since, just absolutely pouring money into creating public opinion in all ways that you can do that, which is they funded think tanks, they funded publications, they fund academics, they give scholarships to students who will hold similar views as theirs. They fund a tremendous array of organizations, and they've actually, you know, founded a number of them themselves.
They founded the Cato Institute, the first libertarian think tank.
Absolutely, the Cato Institute has become a very powerful player in the area of shaping political opinion in the country. I mean, it's quoted all the time as a kind of a nonpartisan and impartial libertarian think tank. But it was founded by the Koch fortune and has been funded by it ever since.
Other think tanks that they've had a lot to do with in terms of funding?
One of the more important, kind of less well-known but very important ones is something called the Mercatus Center, which is at George Mason University in Northern Virginia. And it is a think tank that is very targeted in its approach, basically aimed at gutting all kinds of federal regulations, particularly environmental regulations. And it's been instrumental in attacking the EPA, for instance, which, again, is something that dovetails really nicely with Koch Industries' interests because they're constantly at war with the EPA over their pollution problems.
You said that the Koch brothers created these think tanks to manufacture public opinion. What do you mean by manufacture public opinion?
That reflects, again, reporting I've done. One of the people that I interviewed is a environmental lawyer who tangled with this Mercatus Center a lot. And the way that lawyer put it was that the center was set up almost to kind of launder economics. Businesses come and the industry comes. It donates money to the Mercatus Center. The Mercatus Center then has pedigreed scholars who write papers, and the papers almost always come out promoting whatever the point of view is of the industry. So it's kind of a way of taking industry money and turning it into what looks like impartial academic support, but is actually funded by the industry.
Now you say that at some point the Koch brothers realized that think tanks weren't enough to affect the changes that they wanted, and they needed a mechanism to deliver the message to the public and rally the public around their causes. And at that point, in 1984, they created Citizens for a Sound Economy, which became very vocal during the Clinton administration. So what was Citizens for a Sound Economy?
Well, Citizens for a Sound Economy was a prototype, really, for the current organization they have, the Americans for Prosperity. And what you were reading was actually, this is a quote from Matt Kibbe, who was involved at the time and is a Republican political operative. He's now very involved in the Tea Party movement. He was explaining the roots of this kind of activism. It's corporate-sponsored activism these organizations usually have the names of citizens this or citizens that, such as, you know, Citizens for a Sound Economy. But in fact, they're underwritten by corporate interests. And so that was what that organization did was it, again, was particularly involved in energy policy. It opposed a tax that Clinton was proposing at the time on BTU. And it actually succeeded in killing it. The proposed tax went down to defeat after Citizens for Sound Economy, much like the current Tea Party movement, started organizing rallies in the streets and loud protests in front of Congress and pouring money in to oppose politicians who supported this new tax on energy.
Although the Koch brothers are libertarians and they think government should be stripped to its most minimal role, you say they've been great beneficiaries of government money. Their companies have gotten about $100 million in government contracts since 2000.
That's right. So there's a certain amount of hypocrisy in this libertarian notion. And in fact, there have been some more kind of purist libertarian thinkers who have attacked the Kochs for exactly this, for kind of disguising their corporate self-interest as a kind of a lofty libertarian philosophy. They were also, I think, tremendous beneficiaries during the Bush years of the 2005 energy bill, which was a tremendous giveaway of subsidies and tax breaks to various energy companies.
President Obama has mentioned Americans for Prosperity, a group that David Koch co-founded, at least once. And you quote that. And this was after the Citizens United ruling, which struck down laws prohibiting direct corporate spending on political campaigns. President Obama warned that this had made it easier for big companies to hide behind, quote, groups with harmless sounding names like Americans for Prosperity. They don't have to say who exactly Americans for Prosperity are. You don't know if it's a foreign controlled corporation or a big oil company, unquote. As we speak, the Americans for Prosperity website has a headline, President Obama insults Americans for Prosperity's 1.2 million activists. Has President Obama talked about Americans for Prosperity and its major corporate funding outside of this and the paradox behind, big corporate powers funding seemingly grassroots movements?
Well, I think he also gave a radio address where he mentioned them. So I think maybe he's mentioned them now twice. And I managed for the story to get an interview with David Axelrod, his senior advisor, who expressed a certain amount of frustration, which is, I think, maybe why the White House is beginning to sort of pipe up on the subject a little bit. I mean, their feeling is that a lot of the media has taken the sort of Tea Party rebellion at face value as just kind of an outpouring naturally into the streets and without looking far enough into the corporate interests underlying some of it. And so what David Axelrod told me was, what they don't tell you is that it's a grassroots uprising that's funded by a couple oil billionaires. And they are hoping, it seems, that people will pay more attention to the huge and powerful interests that are really underlying a lot of the opposition to Obama.
Now, I want to mention that the Koch brothers also support a lot of arts and medical institutions. They've done great philanthropic work with the American Ballet Theater, Lincoln Center, the Museum of Natural History, Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. So I think it's important that we mention that.
Yeah, David Koch is really one of the primary philanthropists in New York City at this point. He gave $100 million to renovate the State Theater in Lincoln Center, and he's on the board of the most prestigious cultural organizations in the city, including the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Natural History Museum. And so it's interesting. I mean, and particularly as a writer for The New Yorker, it was interesting for me to sort of connect the dots between that philanthropic role that he plays and this really sort of brass knuckles political role. It's almost as if they're kind of two David Kochs, and it's interesting to kind of put the pieces together.
Did you find a connection?
Well, at a certain point in his life, I think it was in around 1991, he had a near-death experience where he nearly died in a plane crash, and then he was also coincidentally diagnosed with prostate cancer, and he began to re-examine his life to some extent. And it was at that point he started to give away really spectacular amounts of money, particularly to cancer research and particularly to prostate cancer research. You know, I think that David Koch has, you know, you don't want to take that away from him. But at the same time, I have to say one of the things that really shocked me in doing the reporting on this family was that at the same time that David Koch has been, you know, sort of portraying himself as such a champion of the fight against cancer and actually has given a tremendous amount of money to that fight, his company produces a chemical, formaldehyde, in many, many, many products, and they produce it in huge quantities, which the U.S. government has been trying to regulate as a known carcinogen in human beings. And the Koch Industries, through its Georgia-Pacific subsidiary, produces tons of formaldehyde and puts it into tons of products, particularly things like plywood and laminates. And the company's been fighting the regulation of formaldehyde, trying to hold off the EPA from keeping it from flowing freely into the marketplace. And, you know, I just don't know how they can reconcile these two roles.
The Koch brothers have an interesting family political history. Their father was an oil man. In the 1930s, he spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union. You say his company trained Bolshevik engineers and helped Stalin's regime set up 15 modern oil refineries. But eventually, Stalin brutally purged several of Koch's Soviet colleagues. And then he became fiercely anti-communist, became an original member of the John Birch Society. Do you think that his fervent anti-communist beliefs had any effect on his son's beliefs?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and they've talked about it themselves at the dinner table. They were told over and over again that strong centralized governments were evil. And in some ways, and I've interviewed an old family friend of theirs who basically suggests that they transferred their father's paranoia about communism to paranoia about the federal government in the United States and all regulations. And I mean, there was a consistent thread even within the Birch Society there, too, which was that the Birch Society was founded mostly by large businessmen who were opposed to labor unions and you know, minimum wage laws, and specifically opposed to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and a larger federal government. So there's kind of a consistent line that moves from the father, whose name is Fred Koch, to these sons. And I mean, I just don't think you could make some of the details up, though. Who would ever think that behind one of America's most spectacular private fortunes is a father who made his first millions working for Joseph Stalin, setting up the Soviet oil refineries?
So the Koch brothers were brought up by a father who was fervently anti-communist. They grew up with anti-government, anti-big state beliefs. How much of their work now in funding libertarian causes and anti-regulation, how much of that do you think is just like personal political philosophy, and how much of it is like, this will help my corporation make profits?
Well, I think there's no separation between the two in their thinking. They believe that prosperity will result for themselves and others, I guess, if you get rid of all kinds of state regulations and just allow the marketplace to bloom, as they would put it. They see both things as being united, really. One of the things that I found fascinating was that they're not just your sort of ordinary Republican captains of industry. They are really self-described radicals, and Charles Koch specifically calls himself a radical and says he has a radical agenda when he talked to Brian Dougherty in this book, Radicals for Capitalism. Their vision is really pretty far out.
An example of what's far out about it?
Well, you can see their thinking, I think, pretty clearly in the platform of the 1980 Libertarian Ticket, which was when David Koch was the vice presidential candidate. And it called for eliminating Social Security, eliminating income taxes, eliminating corporate taxes, eliminating pretty much every federal agency other than those that enforce kind of basic rights, particularly property rights. So their vision is, it's extreme, you know, from pretty much any direction. It's interesting. But it's not a mainstream kind of widely held view as evidenced by how it did during that campaign, where literally they ran against Ronald Reagan from the right and they got 1% of the vote.
So, Jane, when you look over the years since the Koch brothers have started funding think tanks and groups that are meant to look like grassroots groups, what impact do you think they've actually had on American politics?
Well, I think that you have to credit them with having been relatively successful in disrupting the Obama presidency, which is really what they were hoping to do. I mean, and they've talked pretty openly about it. They organized even before Obama was elected, and Charles Koch talked about how what he saw on the horizon was the greatest threat to freedom and prosperity since the 1930s. And as Obama was being inaugurated, they were organizing groups to attack the stimulus. And I think they've finally reached a kind of a point in 2010 where they've got actual people out on the streets who are fighting for their agenda. And so I think they've, you know, after many, many years of funding all these different networks, that they're having a certain amount of success.
So if the Tea Party movement is in part or maybe even largely the creation of corporate interests like the Koch brothers and their group Americans for Prosperity, and like the group Freedom Works, which have provided a lot of the money for the Tea Party movement, what does that make the people in the movement? Are you saying that they're naive in being used by corporate interests in an apparently anti-corporate campaign?
You know, I guess I'm just not willing to paint them with such a broad brush. This piece is about the Kochs. It's not about all the people who are in the Tea Party movement. And I'm the kind of reporter that's got to get out there and interview people to know what's going on. And I haven't spent enough time talking to people in the Tea Party movement to really understand more. And so I certainly wouldn't want to just sort of dismiss them as some sort of, you know, a mass wave of naivete. I'm sure it's complicated. The Tea Party movement seems to be made of many different kinds of people with many different points of view. It's sort of an amorphous movement anyway. What I'm saying is that in this piece, it's clear that there are huge corporate interests who are trying to channel the angry people that are the foot soldiers of the Tea Party movement and move them in a direction that is good for their own corporate agenda.
Jane Mayer, thank you as always for talking with us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Terry. It's always great to be with you.
Jane Mayer's article about the Koch brothers is in the current edition of The New Yorker. You'll find a link to it on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you'll also find a link to a Koch Industries website, which responds to what it describes as negative attention it's attracted from some people who don't support economic freedom. Today, Americans for Prosperity, co-founded by David Koch, began its Defending the American Dream Summit in Washington. The rally ends Saturday morning, after which they will provide transportation to Glenn Beck's Restoring Honor rally at the Lincoln Memorial. Our guest, British film director Edgar Wright, made a splash with his 2004 comedy about a zombie attack called Shaun of the Dead. He followed that with Hot Fuzz, an offbeat buddy cop spoof set in rural England. Wright's new film, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, is a visually innovative adaptation of a series of graphic novels by Brian Lee O'Malley. The film mixes live action with on-screen graphics and sound effects that evoke pop culture references ranging from Super Mario Brothers to Seinfeld. The film is set in Toronto, where a 22-year-old slacker and bass player named Scott Pilgrim falls for a girl named Ramona Flowers. But he discovers that to win her heart, he must battle her exes. The fight sequences are a mix of video game action and funny dialogue. Edgar Wright spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Let's start with a scene from the film. Scott, played by Michael Cera, is talking about his love life with his roommate Wallace, played by Kieran Culkin.
Why does everything have to be so complicated?
If you want something bad, you have to fight for it. Step up your game, Scott. Break out the L word.
Lesbian?
The other L word.
Lesbians?
It's love, Scott. I wasn't trying to trick you. Hey, buddy, look. If she really is the girl of your dreams, then you have to let her know. You have to overcome any and all obstacles that lie in your path. You can do it. Be with her. It's your destiny. Plus, I need you to move out.
What?
Well, Edgar Wright, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
This movie is really fun. And let me just describe what we see early in the film. We see Scott Pilgrim, this 22-year-old man who's living in Toronto and plays in a band and has an apartment he shares with a friend. And we look at his apartment, and when the phone rings, the letters RRRING exclamation point come spinning out of the phone into the air like in a cartoon. And when we're looking at his apartment, little pop-ups come up explaining, you know, who the lamp belongs to and whether the computer is Scott's or his roommate's, things like that. When someone kisses, little pink hearts float into the screen. What's going on here? What are you doing there?
It's based on a graphic novel which kind of has a lot of those onomatopoeic sound effects within the comic book art. And usually when people do comic book adaptations or even adaptations of video games as films, they tend to kind of like jettison all of the visual tropes and iconography that like make sort of comics and games particularly memorable. Like the things that we know about kind of comic books is that there are sound effects and panels, and sometimes there's like negative space. And so because it's a comedy, and because there's a feeling of that this young man of 22 has a very overactive imagination, that it felt right to me that you're seeing the kind of the film that's in his brain rather than any semblance of reality.
Right. And it's also has a very rich audio mix. Talk about some of the sounds in there that we're maybe not even aware of as we hear them.
Well, aside from the music, there's a lot of sound effects. I mean, in a similar way to kind of the visual presentation, you're sort of seeing the kind of the inner workings of Scott Pilgrim's brain in the sense of the pop culture and media and technology that he's grown up with, you know, in his life. And in a way, it's a representation of some of the pop culture and technology of the last 30 years. So throughout the film, you hear a lot of computer sounds, everything from like PCs to Macs to Nintendo sounds to sounds from old Sega games. And I put them in there to kind of soundtrack something that's happening on screen. So when Scott Pilgrim does something wrong, you hear the Mac error sound. And I wanted to kind of invoke a Pavlovian response in the viewer of that they, when they hear the Mac error sound, they think they've done something wrong. Or when he does something kind of destructive, you hear the Mac trash sound kind of buried in the mix. And it's funny, I think for a certain sort of generation, like some of those sounds are just, you know, like air, you know, it's just things that we hear every day. So I like this idea of like using these little audio kind of like buttons to kind of soundtrack the film.
You know, there is a story here, of course, and this character Scott Pilgrim, it's drawn from the graphic novel by Brian Lee O'Malley. But there's a point at the film at which, you know, he's in a band and he's dating this, he's in love with this young woman, Ramona Flowers, and then he suddenly discovers he has to battle her exes in order to win her heart. But there's a moment at which the film suddenly takes this leap, and he engages in a fight, and he and his, you know, rival are throwing each other through the air, off of buildings, through walls, and it really departs. It really takes a leap into fantasy, and I'm picturing you describing this to some middle-aged studio executives and convincing them it's going to work. What does that sound like?
Well, the irony is that the book was brought to me like in 2004 by the studio, essentially. So, you know, we had the book, so we had the kind of artwork, and they'd seen my previous work, and there's a level of like magic realism in my previous work in terms of, if there's a thread between the two films that I'd done before and the TV series Space that I did with Simon Pegg and Jessica Stevenson, you know, there's definitely a feeling of like everyman characters being thrown into a slightly fantastical world. But I think Scott Pilgrim takes it much further. So the tricky thing with the studio was just actually selling what it would look like and how we would pull off those fights. And it definitely sort of, there's a point in the film where it kind of leaves planet Earth. And to me, that was the most ambitious and risky thing about it, but also the most exciting, because it was, people complain so much about most films being generic. And I thought, well, this is something where the level of reality is going to feel really unique and different. And it almost plays... one of the ways I described like the fights is that I said it should be an action film that's kind of like a musical, is that the fight should be like production numbers. You know, people break into fights like they break into song in old MGM musicals. So I essentially said it was somewhere between The Matrix and Grease. That was my pitch.
Right. Unlike West Side Story, where when a fight is over, the villain doesn't burst into a shower of coins like it does in this film, which is one of the terrific effects that you see.
I'm sure if Robert Wise had that like digital effects in the mid-50s, he would have done exactly the same thing.
Now, there's a moment in the film, and I'm not worried about giving too much of this away to the audience, because when they see it, it'll still be amazing to see. But there's a moment in the film where I maybe a third of the way through, and we're approaching the door to his one-room apartment, and we hear the little four-note bass line from the Seinfeld series.
Yeah.
And then we go in the apartment, and for the next 3 or 4 minutes, there's a studio laugh track, and whenever a new character comes in the door, there's a little applause, and they're sort of acting like Seinfeld. And it's just hilarious. But it occurred to me as I watched that that's the kind of idea that – could really work or could be utterly contrived and lame. How do you figure out what's going to work? Do you test it with your friends? Do you just trust your own sensibility?
I tend to just kind of go for it. I mean, something about this film is a real high wire act in terms of it's, you know, it's definitely got like a go for broke kind of sense of insanity about it. But in a way, in terms of trying to kind of explain kind of what's happening in that scene, again, I thought that, and when we first came up with that, that's something that's not in the books, although there was a thing in the books in the previous scene where you saw Scott and Ramona kissing on a bus, and Brian Lee O'Malley, the artist, had drawn a sign that said studio audience and ah, and I thought that was really funny. And so I thought, well, then the next scene when he comes back to his roommate and he's bragging about the fact that he made out with this girl the previous night, he should walk into the room like Fonzie or like Kramer, and he should be so kind of like full of, you know, he comes back to brag to his roommate and he walks through the door like he's king of the world. So that was where that idea of taking the sitcom thing a little further to have, you know, and Kramer particularly kind of used to have an entrance where the audience would burst into rapturous applause. And I figured that that's what Scott Pilgrim is thinking inside his own head, is that I'm like Arthur Fonzarelli right now. I have my own, you know, kind of wave of adulation from the studio audience.
A lot of the amazing visual stuff clearly was added after you shot it on the set. I mean, the actors are doing this. And what I'm wondering is, were the images that we see on the film, were they in your head as you were shooting, or were you the kind of artist who starts something and then kind of lets the images and effect take you to a place that you maybe you hadn't anticipated?
No, kind of on the contrary, and this is purely because it was a very ambitious project to put together and shoot, was that we prepared everything, we sort of designed everything with storyboards, and you know, a lot of those graphics were already drawn. And actually, there's only one scene in the film where the actors were having to react to something that wasn't there. For the most part, like, they're on physical sets and, you know, or locations, and even when there are graphics, we could actually show them what they were going to see, because sometimes we could actually compose the shot on film but on the video monitor actually have the graphic up on screen. So in that case, and we did a lot of kind of test animation, and say, for instance, there's a sword fight where one of the swords is kind of is pixelated, and that's an effect that you're not going to see until it's all finished. But Jason Schwartzman has a sword in his hand, and Michael Cera has a sword in his hand, so they're still fighting. And I just tried to do as much to let the actors be able to visualize it even as we're shooting. So even down to the thing of... say in the sword fight, we had kind of flash bulbs that I set off every time the two swords connected. So for the actors, even they're essentially doing like a play fight with kind of fake swords, there's this physical thing happening every time that they touch their swords together. And so I tried to take it away from that thing where, you know, you get films that are completely shot on a green screen and people are acting against tennis balls on the end of a stick. And I think 99% of the time, that results in bad performances. So I tried to kind of give the actors as much to go on so they could know what world they were in, so they could adjust their performance accordingly.
I wanted to talk about the 2004 film Shaun of the Dead, which is a zombie film set in suburban England, a world that you knew well. You wrote this with your friend Simon Pegg, who's the lead actor in the film. Where did the idea come from? What was going to be funny about flesh-eating zombies?
That film was really like a love-hate letter to London in a way, because we both lived in the city, and it's about a character stuck in a rut, but there's also a feeling, and the central joke of the film is it was not entirely clear in London which members of the city were living or dead. And certainly having lived in London, and this goes for any big city, I think, is that you could go through an entire day and not have any human connection with anybody. And Shaun was a character who was just drifting through life and is the last to know that there's been a zombie outbreak. So it was kind of funny, and also sort of like in some ways a comment on society in terms of, you know, that people in cities walk past kind of like the sort of the homeless guy, you know, walk past people who are in distress and kind of walk around with their blinkers on and, you know, don't know that something bad is happening until it's too late. And Shaun is somebody who eventually kind of has his kind of moment as a hero, but he's kind of shaken out of his mid-20s life crisis by the zombie outbreak. So even though it's kind of like a pretty crazy comedy, for me and Simon, it was quite personal in a lot of ways.
Well, I wanted to listen to one scene from this. This is a moment that's actually quite late in the film where Shaun, our character played by Simon Pegg, is with Liz, who's played by Kate Ashfield. And they've been fighting off zombies the whole film. They're now surrounded and in a hopeless position. And they'd been dating, but Liz had actually broken up with him the day before. He sort of redeemed himself by showing courage and resourcefulness through the fight. But now the game is up. The zombies are closing in. They have a shotgun with two shells left and decide they got to finish each other off. And let's listen.
How are we going to do this?
I don't know. One of us has to go first.
Well, maybe one should do the other and then do themselves.
Oh, maybe you should do me. I'll only muck it up if I have to do myself.
Do you know, I don't think I've got it in me to shoot my flatmate, my mum and my girlfriend all in the same evening.
What makes you think I've taken you back?
You don't want to die single, do you?
And that's from the film Shaun of the Dead, directed by our guest Edgar Wright. You know, I read that Quentin Tarantino, I think, saw it and became a fan and really wanted to help you. Tell me a little bit about that relationship, how you met and what you did together.
Well, you know, the nicest introductions kind of in this business are through your own work. And he was a big fan of Shaun of the Dead. And, you know, I was a huge fan of his. So, you know, one of the nicest things about making that film was the world getting a little smaller all of a sudden and getting to meet a lot of my heroes and in some cases collaborate with them, because I did one of the trailers for Quentin and Robert Rodriguez's film Grindhouse. But it's something that, like, you know, the British film industry isn't that big, so it was nice kind of like coming to Hollywood and meeting a lot of your heroes and being able to kind of pick their brains. And certainly with Scott Pilgrim, before and after the film, I, you know, sought the advice of people that I respected.
Did Quentin Tarantino have you live in his place for a while you were polishing the script to Scott Pilgrim?
Not as a kept man. he didn't have me. I wasn't prisoner. No, I did stay there for a little bit in his guest house when I was after Hot Fuzz. I wanted to write in Los Angeles, and he offered that I could stay there and write, which was great actually, because I can never write at home. I've never been able to do it in my own apartment, and somehow I could write in his apartment. So it was actually, you know, it had definitely a lucky feeling to it, because I wrote a whole bunch of stuff when I was staying there.
You can't write at home. Where do you write? An office?
Yeah, with Simon we rent an office and come into work, because I think the thing is you have to arrange to meet somebody if you're writing together. I think if you do it in each other's apartments, there's always some kind of errand or some kind of time-wasting excuse of like, I can't come right now because... But if you say, I'll see you at 9:30 tomorrow at the office, there's no getting around that.
The Scott Pilgrim film has been well received by critics, but a couple have said that it's maybe one or two fight scenes too long. And Shaun of the Dead certainly had some has a lot of violence in it, a lot of fun, but violence. And Hot Fuzz ends with a long series of gun battles in this country village. It makes me wonder, are you ever going to resolve things with like a drink and a conversation or a tearful parting?
It's funny. I mean, I think probably as a fan of like genre cinema, I certainly would hold my hands up as being guilty of going as far over the top as I possibly can. I basically keep going until the time and the money runs out. But I think, and it's funny actually, doing Scott Pilgrim is interesting. Doing test screenings with cold audiences is you had to kind of find that balance of comedy and action. And in some cases, actually, the fights were longer in Scott Pilgrim, and we sort of tightened them up because I realize as a fan of like Hong Kong cinema that I can happily sit through a 20-minute fight scene, whereas not all Western audiences will be able to kind of face that. But, you know, personally, you know, I like watching that stuff, if okay. I'm being honest.
Well, Edgar Wright, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Edgar Wright directed the new film Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. You'll find links to clips from the film, as well as excerpts of the graphic novel it's based on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.